The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Blair L.M. Kelly's Black Folk, The Roots of the Black Working Class, is an exhaustive coast-to-coast narrative that seeks to reclaim Black workers' central contributions to workers' rights throughout U.S. history. She is also the author of Right to Ride, Streetcar Boycotts, and African American Citizenship, and the director of the Center for the Study of the American South and co-director of the Southern Futures Initiative at the University of North Carolina. She will be joined in conversation this evening with Mark Lamont Hill, author, news and podcast host, and the Steve Charles Chair in Media, Cities, and Solutions at Temple University. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
Everybody, good evening. Y'all came out on a hot summer day. It is so good to see everybody here. That's how I could tell you have Philly roots.
Yeah.
Because people,
yeah, I got Philly whole folk family came section out. Right,
yes,
here.
Yes. I could see the family. I could tell right away. This is an opportunity to talk to, sincerely, one of the most interesting and important historians in the academy today. Blair Kelly is so gifted as a writer and as a thinker and as a public intellectual. I don't know if you like that term, but yeah. It's yours now. You got to take it. And this book for me, Black Folk, The Roots of the Black Working Class, is such an important intervention, such an important opportunity for all of us to think with you and learn from you about the Black experience. And you are a historian. Mm-hmm. Of the Black experience.
Yes.
Not of labor.
No.
But it matters to labor, right? Yes. You're, I guess what I want to say is, and I'm going to start asking you questions. This book is so interesting and important because while you are a specialist in this area, you piece together these different areas and traditions and ways of thinking that, and you make a real contribution to all of them, you know, and you write so good.
Thank you.
Good. She write good. So, first I'm going to start with the question I ask everybody, which is a very simple question. Why this book? Why now?
Honestly, this wasn't the book I was writing or was thinking about writing. And I was approached about writing the history of the Black working class. And there's a book called White Trash that's out that was very successful. And so my editor was like, well, what would be the equivalent? And I'm like, certainly not Black Trash. That's not a thing.
I know that's right.
No, thank you. And so he said, well, what is it? And so I began to sit with the question of what is it? And for me, starting with family and starting with their stories and their journey was how my mind framed it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if that's exactly how I would insert history. Because, you know, my family weren't Pullman porters or, you know, it didn't fit perfectly, but it fit perfectly for me.
Yeah.
And it was the beginning of my thinking. And so that's how I came to think about it. And, you know, class has such fraught power in the academy, right? Yeah. You know, if you talk about the working class, like, it has definitions and sociological things behind it and this, that, and the other thing. And so I was like, well, I'm not doing that perfectly because a lot of people wouldn't put people who did agricultural work in a working class. They would only put factory workers or,
right,
you know, those kinds of traditional spaces. But for me, I was like, let's broaden this out. Like, who said that that's how we had to do it? And so I began to think more broadly about where do we come from and what is the stuff we bring with us when we show up.
Yeah. One of those places, not the only place, and certainly not the starting place, but slavery is an important thing that we have to think about. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you don't write a lot about slavery in the book, but you certainly situate or start us there in a certain way.
Yes.
Which is interesting because, to your point, mm-hmm. there are a lot of people, Marxists, for example,
yes.
who would say...
Slaves can't be.
Yeah, that ain't working class. There's no... That's not... We weren't... Well, you know, you said... You go. Go.
Yeah. So there's a certain sense that, you know, class consciousness comes from work sites that are certain kinds of work sites. But it's based on a European model, right? It's based on their model of development and this notion that a consciousness has to be raised.
Yeah.
And for me, that always was strange for Black people because I didn't see that. I didn't see that anybody had to come tell us what was going on in America. Right. Like, people showed up and were like, cool, that sounds good. I'm with you because you're fighting my enemy.
Yeah.
But never did they have to be taught. And I think a lot of the literature implicitly has that in it, particularly traditional labor literature, and I never liked that. So I wanted to say, well, what do Black people bring to this analysis based on their experience in being enslaved, and how do they carry that forward? And for me, that was so important, because how we come to this country is so unique, and how we show up here, and what we have to do to survive, and then what we do then to thrive, is a discrete set of steps that's unique to us. And I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. And you do that in such a beautiful way. And I'm going to keep coming back to the beauty of this book, because I was taught to think that when you read history in school or when you read history on the shelf, God forbid you read. I mean, I own a bookstore, and getting people to go to the history shelf sometimes is hard because they think that's where they're going to go to sleep. Like,
yes.
It's a good thing we sell coffee,
it's
too.
Like, it's, you know, like punishment, saying? Yeah.
Right. It's like, why would I do wrong, right? But there's a way that you make history captivating. Some of that is just your pen, right? That's just mm-hmm. your gift as a writer, which, and I liked your last book, but this is a whole different,
yes,
different mission, different project, different genre.
Yes.
You writing your behind off in this thing. You put your foot
Thank
in
you.
This.
Thank you.
But there's also a way and a beauty that I want you to talk about in the way that you highlight the ordinary. You just said that there's a, you know, your family weren't Pullman porters and they weren't this and they weren't that. And I was like, yeah, that's true, mm-hmm. but that's almost the point.
Yes, yes. That, I have family on this side, too.
Where they at? Where they at? Oh, see? There we go.
And then
there
I have
we
family
go.
On that side. So that's my mama's side, and that's my daddy's side.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. Y'all cool? Y'all loud? It's five seats in the middle. Did something happen? I'm just asking. It wouldn't be the first time. But there's a beauty in telling the stories, use the word experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it wasn't just about labor and alienation and all these kind of academic terms. It was, how did Black people live? How did we carry ourselves? How do we understand ourselves? How do we treat each other? What was our culture? Like, we were human beings.
Absolutely.
That's what this book shows. Mm. How do you manage to do that in a book? Like, what's your journey, like your process to get to that? Yeah.
My desire is always, and I teach my students this, if you can put yourself on someone's shoulder and you can look around and you can see what they see and you can experience their journey, their walk day to day, and you can try to rebuild that from your sources, then you can bring someone into the humanness of their walk. Because
yeah.
we all have our own experiences, right? We all have our own histories and our own particularities. And so I just want you to see some of those in my historical figures. Now, that work is hard, right? Because I'm not making it up.
Right.
I got, you know, notes in there. But
a lot of them.
Yes. But I still want that humanness and that real fragile touch that I think is so important for understanding their walk and their journey and how you might have negotiated and really move along with them. That's always my desire. And this book gave me space to do that in a way that I think some histories would not. You know, it's seen as indulgent to do that kind of work.
Yeah.
But for me, that's the storytelling aspect of it is so crucial to make you buy in and believe.
And you do that from the beginning. Talk to me about, I love these old Black names.
I know, come on now.
Solicitor.
Yes.
It's... I mean, just the beauty of naming your child solicitor. So that every white person, I don't know if this was the mission, but I just imagine, or sergeant, or Mm-hmm. All these other, so every white person don't even look you in the eye, but they get sergeant. Right? You got to call me sergeant.
Mm-hmm. And Solicitor also named his sons O-B-S-T. Now, O-B was O-B-B-I-E.
Right.
But you had to say O-B because you weren't going to call him, like, his name.
Yeah.
You were going to call him by his initials.
That's right.
Like a man.
That's right.
So he did that intentionally. John D. was my grandfather. Yeah. But J.D., like, you know, all of them were going to be.
That's how my father was.
Mm-hmm.
He was L.M. Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad was L.M.
Mm-hmm.
And when he, and my Uncle Bobby, after who the store's name, they're all from Wilkes County, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And then World War II fought and then came to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And my dad actually renamed himself
uh-huh.
Leon Melvin later, because when he went in the Army, like, you got to have a name, man. You can't be L.M. You know, but them initials got them a certain kind of respect
yep.
that didn't. Now, the story of Solicitor is an important one, though, because it yes. kind of begins your journey, your family's journey to Philadelphia
yes.
through, you know, the Carolinas, et cetera.
Yes.
But talk to us a little bit about that story, because I think that's a powerful and beautiful one.
So it's a story my mother told. My mother loved to tell me stories again and again and again. And it, for me, I always saw it as one of my founding stories. And she would repeat the stories, and I'd be like, oh, mama, like, I know this story now. And she'd be like, so anyway. And she would tell it again. and so she told the story of her her grandfather escaping Georgia. And she always said they ran like slaves. She always, you know, added that in. Because she wanted me to understand that although slavery had ended, the subjugation that surrounded people continued. She never wanted me to be confused about that.
Yeah, yeah. That's an important point. Again, this the sharecropping context in so many ways. I mean, there's a way that you're talking about this. I forgot that we were free when I was reading some of the stuff you were talking about. Even the way they had to run. You don't pay me my money.
Yep.
A year's worth. This ain't small amount.
Yes.
I can't say nothing about it because I'm scared of getting lynched. I can't do this. I can't do that. Now, I got to leave town.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fleeing as if he was fleeing a slave plantation.
Because he's fleeing debt.
Hmm.
And so debt had power. So if he was running from debt, he owed that landholder money after working for an entire year. And so that was the root of their story. So they didn't have anything to run with. They didn't have any money to run with. You know, they just had themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's always an incredible, you know, harrowing tale every time I heard it from my mom, from my grandfather. They repeating that to me when I was little, it stuck with me.
Yeah, it stuck with me as I was listening to it. I was Googling to see if our families were connected. I was like, there's too many connections. That's the first thing I did.
Yes.
But I was also fascinated to see what the conditions were in the North because, you know, no doubt different and better than the South in certain ways, but not idyllic.
No.
Talk to me about what the Black working class life looked like in the North at this moment.
So it was that mixed bag, right? So you got away. There was one migrant who wrote, you know, nobody called me boy. I don't have to step off the sidewalk for white women. I don't have to do this, that, and the other. I'm saving money. This is where I want to be. My kids are in school every day. So it was a change, right? It was a fundamental change. And yet you were in a space that was too tight. My grandparents rented a room in a building, not a whole apartment. And it was partitioned off from other people when they first came. They couldn't keep my mom there. She talked about hiding under the bed when the landlord would come. She couldn't stay with her mom during the week because she was a live-in domestic. And there were all these things that were just painful for them when they first came. And that stuff was expensive, too. None of it was cheap. None of it was easy. None of it was like a chance to get a leg up. It was hard. And it was difficult.
A lot of academics now, to the point that it makes me want to punch them in the face, they use the term racial capitalism. It's like you can't have a sentence without the word without racial capitalism.
I have a paragraph in there where I basically explain what racial capitalism in plain English.
Which is so helpful. Which was so helpful, right?
Without saying racial capitalism.
But also, some academics need to read it because I don't think they know what it is either. Right? But that's neither here nor there.
LOL.
But my point in mentioning it is you show us rather than tell us how capitalism in so many ways is dependent upon the racialization of a group of people. There are things, labor markets, forms of exploitation, but also forms of resistance.
Yes.
That emerge in your book precisely because that's Negro work.
Mm-hmm.
That's Black. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, I'm going to start with the washerwomen.
Yes.
Because I think the way you write about them again, I'm not just, I don't do this. If some of y'all come to these, I don't do this all the time. Some of these books ain't that good, but this one is. And just so y'all know. But the way you talk about washerwomen, I didn't know there was anything else to know about them.
Me too.
Literally. I mean, here we go with the washerwomen. I ain't gonna lie. When I read, I was like, here we go with the washerwomen. Right? But then I was like, oh, wait, there's stuff to know about the washerwomen. Talk about that as a kind of form of racialized labor. Talk about who they were and what they had to do with being black.
Okay, so the reason why neither Mark or I thought there would be something to add is there's a beautiful book called To Join My Freedom by a historian named Tara Hunter, who wrote about the washerwoman strike of 1881 in Atlanta. And it's a beautiful book. It's foundational to my entire career as a historian. I wouldn't be here without that book and the work of Robin Kelly, period. So when I sat down to write this chapter, I approached Tara Hunter and I was like, you know, I want to have a chapter about washerwomen. And she was like, a chapter? I was like, and I felt all bad. And so I was like, okay. And then I sat down to write it and I freaked out. I was like, is there going to be anything left to say? But I had tools that both Tara and I didn't have on that, you know, earlier time period. I now have Ancestry.com and I have Newspapers.com. And so I could type in.
That's major, by the way.
Huge, huge. So the keyword searching of like washerwomen in all these black newspapers, white newspapers, newspapers in general.
Just to be clear, as opposed to going downstairs in here, pulling out the microfiche, looking at this and trying
reading day by day. Like on my first book, I literally roll the microfilm and like read. Read for months in the newspaper.
Just hoping to bump into some stuff on washerwomen.
I mean, which was great context, right? So I love, you know, reading those papers because I'm a rabbit holer.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm a historian. But at the same time, it's just, there's only so much you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And with these technologies, you can do a lot. You still have to read through it once you hit it. So I put in washerwomen and I got thousands of hits. I was like, okay. Let's look. And so what I found was the Atlanta strike was not unusual. It was unusual in its size, but it was not unusual at all.
Yeah.
There were strikes, mini strikes, threats of strikes, washerwomen joining in other people's strikes, fighting back against different rules and regulations all over the entire
Explain what a washerwoman is first.
A washerwoman, you know, we all have a washing machine in our house or in a local laundromat that we can go to, put our stuff in, a little soap, and you're done. Back in the day, you had to, like, actually wash your own clothes. You had to, washerwomen made soap. They boiled water. They gathered people's clothing, usually several different customers, and then they washed that in their backyards by hand. They had to hang it and twist it and iron everything because everything needed ironing. There was no polyester. And it was arduous, hard work. It was associated with black women in slavery. White women of any stature would seek out the opportunity to have somebody else wash their clothes. Even if they were dirt poor, they were trying to keep those wash lines out of their yard because it was a marker. It was a public marker that you didn't have any money. And so washerwomen had this enormous cachet to get all that work. Low-paid work, difficult work, but work that kept them out of white homes. They didn't have to go inside anybody's home. They didn't have to be touched or bothered by a white male employer. They could, you know, just gather that stuff up, go to their own yards, watch their own kids, be next to their own households, and work. And so it was a preferred kind of domestic work.
Yeah. I think we only think about it in the context of labor exploitation oftentimes.
Yes.
We only talk about it like these poor women who were overworked and underpaid, which is 1,000% true.
Yes.
There's also a magic to what they were doing that you write about in the book.
Absolutely.
And we're going to get to the resistance part of it, but just there's something beautiful about the way you describe them and talk about them. They just you just capture the beauty and dignity and agency that's attached to Washington. To the washerwoman.
So for me, you know, there's a sociological concept of skilled work versus unskilled labor. And pretty much everything black people did was considered unskilled. And carpentry, masonry, you know, bricklaying, those kinds of things were considered skilled work. Black men were generally kept out of those professions, sometimes by law, in the Jim Crow South, and then by de facto customs in the North. And so black workers are thought of as unskilled. But during the pandemic, I started watching those beautiful union videos of farm workers on the West Coast, like bundling vegetables and, like, you know, doing things where you look down and it looks like magic, that they would have a bundle of radishes or greens or asparagus with just, you know, quick swipes of the hand that you can't even see. You would need to slow down the film to catch all the things that they do. And they're classed as unskilled. And so I'm thinking, well, the rest of us would, like, chop into our hands or hurt ourselves or, you know, be in pain from just bending over to get close to the vegetables, let alone bundle them up perfectly each time over and over and over again. And so it created a whole world for me in thinking about, you know, washerwomen made soap. They made their own starch, their own concoctions to raise stains. Like, they knew all this science behind washing clothes.
Right.
Who said that they were unskilled?
Right.
Who said that? And so I'm not going to say that at all. I'm going to say that they're skilled. I'm going to amplify the work and the care and the knowledge that went into what they did.
There's something also really interesting about what it means for that clothing line in the backyard to not just be a sign of class status, but in some ways racial identity.
Absolutely.
Right? I don't want this in my backyard because that's Negro labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be associated with Negro labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a way that you talk about in the book that Negro women cornering the market on clothes washing allowed them to have a certain kind of economic advantage.
Their monopoly.
Yeah, and a monopoly which then allowed them to make certain moves in terms of labor advocacy, in terms of all the things.
Absolutely. I mean, the first union I can find in the record for washerwomen is 1865 in Jackson, Mississippi.
Wow.
And those women come out of enslavement and organize a union and say, okay, this is what we want to make a living wage. This is where we want to do the work. We're going to do it in our own yards. We're not going in your yard to do your laundry. And this is, and if any of the women who are trying to cross us, we're going to, you know, cut them out and they're going to get in trouble with us. And we're all together. Let's go. And so for me, that's powerful, you know, because that speaks to the knowledge that they had in enslavement and the vision that they had for their freedom. That was immediate. It wasn't, you know, we need some time to think and come together. Nope. And the folks there are mad from the get. They're like, we have never liked those dang washerwomen. They get on our nerves. And you could find that in the record, too, the same way. And so it's a powerful reminder that they understood we could take a day off if we want to. We don't have to do stuff on Sundays. We're not doing this over Christmas. We're not doing this for the holidays. You better get your stuff washed before. Because all together, we're not going to wash your clothes. You can't find one in the city who will. And so they set the terms of their own labor.
I don't think that that's, and I don't know how y'all feel about this, but I don't think that that's part of our collective popular memory of the black working class, and particularly of black women at that time, that they were saying no.
Absolutely.
That they were resisting, that they were setting the terms of their own. We had, I'm reading this stuff and I'm like, oh, damn, okay. I mean, it made sense, but we're not even given an opportunity to think about black women in that way.
Yep.
Now, that doesn't mean, though, that they weren't vulnerable to all sorts of
Absolutely.
Stuff. Can you talk a little bit about some of the, I don't want to, because you also don't romanticize what they
No.
went through.
No, I mean, you know, there were women who were killed when they were trying to negotiate prices or get paid for what they had already done. There were women who were attacked and raped and drugged somewhere. It was really not a crime to rape a black woman anywhere in the United States at a certain point. So
Right.
just being, you know, mobile and moving around a city was a danger. But they sought to protect themselves as best they could. And the attraction to that kind of work was a really powerful one for protecting their children and protecting their families as best they could.
Why protecting their children?
So in slavery, you can't watch your kids, right? So enslaved women are leaving their babies under trees and hoping for the best, or they're being taken from them and watched collectively by older women. And so the children don't even know their mothers because they don't see them in daylight. You know, that's what Frederick Douglass said. He couldn't recall his mother's face because he never saw her in the daylight. So to be free would mean to raise your own, right? And to have them running around your feet as you work. And you can teach them what you're doing. They can help out. But they're with you, and that you can make that web of safety. And you can work with other women. So you see these beautiful images of wash yards of groups of women working collectively to help one another.
I talked a moment ago about sort of how we remember black women, but that's not just because we haven't thought about it enough or because we're reading the wrong books. There's a way that mainstream history has mischaracterized black women, even at the time, you know.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of what they did and how?
So I think one of the only historians from back in the day was Carter G. Woodson, who looked at the washerwomen and said, wow, that's power. You know, they're entrepreneurs. They're saving up funds to build houses and taking care of people and educating that next generation. And so he wrote this big, beautiful elegy to them. But most people really discounted and were ashamed of the connection to slavery,
yeah.
Right? And so even black historians were like, well, that's, you know, let's make it more professional, more modern. We want different kinds of jobs. But in doing so, that move discounted the value and the power of what they were really doing.
Yeah. Just in the interest of time, I could talk to you forever. Oh, my God. this is the problem. There's so much in this book, and it's so beautiful. Let me pivot for a minute to the Pullman Porters.
Mm-hmm.
We know more about them.
Yes, we do.
But talk a little bit about who they were. And again, I think about them, you're writing about them as a piece, there's a labor piece to it.
Yes.
But again, you also assign to them, you write them into history in a way that assigns to them a certain kind of, again, dignity, sophistication, mm-hmm. cosmopolitanism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. It's one of the things when I read, I was like, oh yeah, this makes sense. Of course, they travel all over the country. Like, why mm-hmm. wouldn't they? These are the most learned, most sophisticated, most knowledgeable Negroes in the country. But I hadn't thought about them in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about who they were and their significance.
So George Mortimer Pullman was...
garbage.
Yeah, yes. And the inventor of the sleeping car. And so before, if you traveled on the train, you had to sort of sleep on like some kind of cot, and it would be uncomfortable, and you know, it wasn't attractive. So his vision was to make the cars comfortable. They would go from daytime seating that was luxurious and fancy to nighttime seating that was nighttime sleeping that was private and where you could, you know, just rest as if you were at home. And so the fulfillment of that vision was that it would be like the antebellum South. You would have a black manservant waiting on you hand and foot, ready to do whatever. And so he hired all black men to do that work.
That's so fascinating.
And he leased them with the cars. That was the other thing that was really powerful for me. So he owned the cars. You know, the cars were leased to rail companies, but the men were leased along with it. So they always worked for Pullman. They never worked for the railroads, which in the earliest generations allowed him to get around some of the labor laws that would have protected rail workers.
Mm. And to be clear, He was especially bad to Negroes, but
he was bad to white people too.
Yeah, I mean, right.
He's notorious in history for being like an awful person to laborers.
Hmm.
You know,
I think about he was really trash. But like, there's a way that if similar to Du Bois and Black Reconstruction, there's a way that Du Bois talks about Black Reconstruction. There's a way that if the white workers actually were more committed to labor solidarity, they could have worked with the Pullman Porters to have
Absolutely.
An even bigger labor movement.
It would have been much more powerful.
Right, but they're like, we not them.
Yeah, no, they were comfortable with the segregation part, and right. then they got jacked by him anyway.
But the idea, right, right, don't feel that bad for me. The idea that there's a whole job created
mm-hmm.
for the black person,
mm-hmm.
precisely because we wanted to look and feel like slavery. We want white people to feel like, you know, we were great again.
Yes, and then you accidentally create the largest private employer of black men in the country.
Wow. Which, again, I don't want to romanticize this because there's a way that they were vulnerable.
That's some hard work.
Did some hard work, thankless work,
mm-hmm.
and they were still Negroes. So, I mean, they couldn't, like, they had some rules governing who they could touch. And how, I mean,
mm-hmm. you couldn't touch a white woman. You couldn't be in the space with a white woman alone. They, you know, all the sort of assumptions about rape from black men toward white women undergirded everything they had to do. So they had to be constantly thinking about how not to appear to be touching or
so
alone.
So she's slipping and falling. Too.
You gotta let her fall like a brick, I guess. Because you can't touch her.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they also had Pullman maids. So black women were hired to wait on women in those spaces. Meanwhile, the people who needed protection on trains were Black women travelers, right?
Because nobody was protecting them.
No one was protecting them.
So we have Pullman porters, and then we get a union.
We get a union.
How do we get from this exploited class of, I mean, it's not indentured servitude, but it's, they like related. Like it, there's a way that I read this, and I'm like, wow, this how is this legal, right?
They sometimes would be on cars for long periods of time because they'd be told to be assigned somewhere far off. So the whole ride there, you weren't paid. Like, you know, deadheading basically on trains for hours, days.
So I'm from Philly. I get assigned to work in California or Texas or something. So I'm just riding to work. I'm not getting paid that whole ride.
Mm-hmm.
And it ain't like my feet are up and I'm riding first class with a cocktail. Right. So I'm working. And then suddenly I look up and there's a labor union organizing. There's a labor movement organizing of Pullman porters, which turns out to be an extraordinary, I mean, a watershed moment in U.S. labor history.
Absolutely. I mean, the presence of A. Philip Randolph, who's not a porter himself, the son of a preacher who's a socialist and interested in organizing Black workers in the country, is invited by the Pullman porters to help organize them. They've been trying for decades to organize a union, and would get cut off because those folks would just get fired. So they needed somebody who could be independent and be an independent voice. He had a newspaper in Harlem, and so he became a voice of their movement. But it took, under his leadership, another decade before they could actually form a real union that was recognized by the federal government.
When you think about, I'm gonna jump just a little bit for time's sake. Talk to me about today. I'm thinking about the Black working class, and I'm thinking about the kind of vulnerability that they continue to suffer, and how that vulnerability has never waned in certain ways, but was certainly spotlighted during the pandemic.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about what it means to be Black working class when this pandemic takes over the whole world.
I was struck, I was writing the book when the pandemic came. And so I was already sort of keen to thinking about a working class and Black postal workers, CNAs, grocery store folks, folks who were driving for Amazon, folks who were doing Uber Eats and all these different things, people, bus drivers, folks who were very vulnerable and never, you know, had this time off and this quarantine period. They worked straight through all those things, facing people who were ill the entire time and suffering disproportionately under the title essential worker. And it was just incredibly powerful to consider that longer history of really discarding the health and the lives of Black workers in really clear ways that just bothered me, because there was no acknowledgement. There was no thank you. There was no pay time off. There was no acknowledgement that, you know, maybe we really should do something here to make sure that there's a living wage for all of these folks. You know, not remembering that longer histories of exploitation amplified an exploitation in our current moment.
What's the through line? What's the connecting kind of tissue from a solicitor to people who are working on the plant at the plant for Tyson Foods or working at Uber Eats, in terms of their condition, their labor, their experience?
I think there's both, you know, the habit of exploitation and the habit of disregarding the value of Black workers and Black life in itself. But then there's also the determination. I think it's no accident that in our generation, when we see a resurgence of union organizing, it's coming from Black people, often in places where they are tremendously dispossessed.
Alabama, and, Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, places where unions are not anything. You live in the South, the union is anathema, and yet there's more Black union workers than any other class of working class folks, percentage-wise, right? And they're living in the South, the area the most hostile to unions in the United States. And so there's something really powerful about what we think about ourselves that's still at play.
We're going to take questions from the audience, so have your questions ready. I'm going to ask one more question just to give you all a second to think. I'm gonna ask you as an academic, the thing we hate the most is solving problems and having actual.
LOL.
Yeah, don't ask me how to fix it. I'll tell you what's wrong with it. What does the black working class need?
I think the black working class needs to be heard. I think if we center the black working class, the entire country would benefit. Mm. If you think from the perspective of a black woman worker and what she needs to support her every day, that she needs a living wage, that she needs access to affordable housing, that she needs good schools for her kids, that she needs daycare until they can get to the schools. She needs health care. She needs a retirement. She needs all these things to support. She needs decent roads and good transportation to back and forth to work. If you think about all the things that are important and necessary, she needs paid time off. She needs care protection if we hit another pandemic. She needs protection from environmental dangers. If you take care of those questions, then you are taking care of all workers. No one will be missed in that formula. Yeah. If you happen to center them. So, and you can see that black people are politically engaged more than any other working class in the country. And so they have the habits of citizenship. They're voters. They're organizers. They're leaders in their own communities. And so if you center them and you center their voices and you listen to what they have to say as well, boy, you change a lot of good things.
So why are they not the center of our political, discourse for sure, but also what you said makes a whole lot of sense. And there's a whole lot of working class folk. Mm-hmm. But we don't target not only the black working class, but in general, we target the middle class. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like a used car salesman, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to have a presidential election and the candidates, except maybe one, who shall remain nameless, we'll be talking about the middle class. Mm-hmm. We're going to save the middle class. We're going to rescue the middle class. We're going to whatever for the middle class. Why is the black working class or the working class more broadly such so distant from our kind of political aspiration, our political vision, our political sort of strategizing? I mean, it would seem to me that if you said, like what you just said makes a whole lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. But everybody's trying to save the middle class.
Well, because we have no class in America. So everybody's middle class. Like you and I are middle class. Somebody's making $30,000 middle class. Everyone's middle class. And so it doesn't make any sense. We don't like to talk about class. We don't like to talk about living wage. We don't like to talk about that we make it impossible for people to buy houses in the communities where they live. We don't like to talk about those things. And so we just sort of gloss over it and paint over it because we've made this promise to white America that they will have access if they just, you know, go along, get along. Eventually, they're going to have the things that they need. And we just keep circulating that little tired, dry story over and over again. And we don't talk about, you know, the vulnerabilities that working people share in general. We don't frame things in those terms.
I like this. Questions from the audience.
I heard you on NPR, and you're talking about the influence and the history of the domestics. Mm-hmm. And what is your position on what their legacy is and their importance in Black history and where we are today? My grandmother, my great grandmother, domestics, and I lived in West Philly, but went to school in the main line. I always remember the domestic being dropped off at 52nd and City Line Avenue after they'd been on the main line doing people's work every day. So I had a connection to it on both sides. So what's your position on what the legacy and importance of them are?
I mean, I sit in that legacy. That's work my grandmother did. She lived in North Philadelphia when she first migrated from Thomasville, North Carolina. And she did that work, from what I can ascertain, for more than a decade. And I think what's been powerful for me is in this journey, talking with different communities about this book, everyone has, you know, that story in their family. There's nobody who's like, oh, yeah, nah, we was all elite.
Right.
I think I ran into one woman who's like, yes, it's very interesting. But everyone else, you know, that's their story. Their grandmother did that work. Their mother did that work. Their great-grandmother did that work. Their you know, they're connected to laundry work, they're connected to domestic work. And the vulnerability that those women endured was incredible. To be atomized, to be away from your family, to be away from other women workers, right? You're alone in a house. A lot of them are vulnerable to sexual assault, to not being properly paid, to being exploited in any number of ways, to be given clothing instead of money at the end of the week. Any number of things could happen and there would be no recourse. They were exempted from federal law, law that protected you with a minimum wage and a set number of hours, particularly because Southern lawmakers and lawmakers in general thought it was inconvenient to provide that kind of coverage. So, there's a profound legacy there, and yet they did that work when my grandmother had a high school education. She wanted to work at the Navy Yard, and they weren't hiring black women when she first came to the city to do that kind of work. And eventually, she gets that job. There's a blockage there and a forgetting that, the country is committing. When we talk about the first generation of women workers, we talk about Rosie the Riveter going to help out during the war cause. The numbers that I saw helped me to understand that Rosie the Riveter went to work while black women kept her house and watched her kids and cooked her dinner and shopped for her groceries. And so we made the black woman invisible and we made the white woman into a hero. And so it's a powerful set of sacrifices that black women had to undergo to get us to this point. And black women are still doing that work.
Ooh, Lord, yes.
Thank you. Congratulations as well on the book. I'm from North Carolina too.
I'm
from Greensboro. I'm about to go to NC State.
Yeah.
So I know you used to teach there. So I said,
yeah, 20 years.
Yeah. One question I had was, do you come anything across black immigrant workers within the working class? Just a question I had. Thank you.
Since I have been touring, I want to think about what comes next and what the reaction to and the experience of writing a book like this has made me think differently about what comes next for me.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so I would love to write about, from the perspective of my father's generation, this was really, I think, from my grandparents' generation.
Perspective
and to talk about the presence of black immigrants into domestic work where they are predominant right now, and to sort of bring it more fully out of like a 20th century moment, to talk about the complications of community and race that get created with the presence of folks from around the diaspora as part of those communities. But there are people from the diaspora in this story. Of course, there were Pullman porters, there were domestic workers.
Sure.
There was a union of black women and domestic workers in the 1940s in Harlem that included a lot of immigrant women. So they're in this book, but I think there's a particular argument, I think, that needs to be made about the transition over time to the reliance on women from abroad to do domestic work and nannying in our contemporary culture.
Yeah. Thank you for being here tonight. I'm excited to read your book. I'm halfway through the last book I bought, my last author talk, Philadelphia, Corrupt and Consenting, and learning about the corruption and racial prejudice in the building trades unions and how black workers are denied the protection of those unions because of the present racial segregation and racial prejudice. I'm curious if in the book, if you found or in the history, if black workers were more successful or less successful having their own unions, and your thoughts on today of how black working class workers can get those protections and establish unions if there is existing racial prejudice.
Absolutely. I think the particular things that you see in the existence of these all black unions are that their concerns are not just the concerns of the workers in their strictly defined class, right? So when Pullman, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Forwarders, is formed, they don't just say, okay, well, let's just keep raising our pay and like getting our power together. They immediately pivot to advocating for black workers in general to have access to federal employment. And then they start what's called the March on Washington movement, which becomes eventually the March on Washington that we all know in 1963. And so they're not just using their status and their newfound victory for themselves. Postal workers are doing the same thing. They're using that status and that power of federal employment and union organizing to make sure that they're advocating for civil rights in general, that they're fighting segregation, that they're fighting for access, and they're fighting for jobs and better pay for all workers. So that, for me, black unions stand out in particular in ways that don't just amplify their own field, but really amplify what's available to Black people in general. And so I think when I see Black unionists now, I hear those same kinds of critiques of the wider society and the way that the gig economy and the sort of Amazon framework undergirds disempowerment for so many people. And so when I hear them talking, they're not just talking about, like, you know, we right here need to get better to right here. They're really creating and mounting a critique that I think is important.
Congratulations on your book. I had a question about whether you think, based on what I've heard from the book, because I haven't read it yet, that this is information that children in schools are learning or they're being denied. And do you see anything positive coming out? Are we seeing more representation of Black people in just across the board?
Representation in the way we talk about this or representation in the labor world?
I found out a lot of things that I never heard of before. Not that that's surprising for me. But also, like, I remember a couple of years ago, for example, Oscar's So White. And then today I heard that women rappers are getting all the awards. So what are you seeing that's good?
Okay, so there's a lot in there. So I'm gonna pull two things out. One is you're bringing into the conversation stuff that we just were never taught before.
Yeah, no, I didn't learn any of this in school. Like, I had a hard time learning about, like, Du Bois and
right.
accurate fashion or, like, Reconstruction. I remember, like, I went and did, you know, projects on Reconstruction,
yeah.
Civil rights movement, because it was very thin in what we learned. And looking at what my children have learned and had access to, it's a little better, but it's not mainstream history.
Yeah.
That happens in the academy. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done. But there's also, there's a war on history right now.
I was going to say now.
An active, you know, vicious war on history. I mean, there are people banning books on Jackie Robinson in public libraries and school
Jackie
libraries.
Jackie Robinson.
If you can't tell Jackie Robinson's story, whose story can you tell?
Right.
I mean, that's very, you know, he played baseball really well. He played, now he wants to play with white people too. Isn't that nice?
Right.
He went through some things.
Snitched on Paul Robeson.
I had to prevent my students from writing about Jackie Robinson in class because all the, you know, young white men knew about Jackie Robinson. And they were all like, I just want to do a project on him. I'm like, that's cool. No,
right.
We're going to do someone else.
Anybody else, right.
So now we're in a society where we're about to devolve away from Jackie Robinson. Like, good night. So, no, I'm very concerned that people will have less and less access to the history we're doing. I think in the academy, there's more and more space to do this work. There are more Black people in the academy. There's more people interested in Black questions in the academy.
Yeah.
And there's, but it's under siege.
Yeah. And I think the second part of your question, was sort of asking the question of are there spaces of progress or bright moments, bright spots, even signs of hope for the Black working class and what we've seen lately?
I think being able to even write this book is a sign of hope for me, right?
Mm.
I think me running a place called the Center for the Study of the American South as the first Black woman to do so in a 30-year period is a... Thank you. But it's a dark spot that I'm the first. It's a dark spot that I'm the first, right? You know, it's to me, it's unacceptable to be the first of anything. And yet, you know, here we go on, like, some baby steps. But... Yeah. Uh-huh.
Got it.
It's insufficient.
It's like, I guess, right?
Hi there. Thank you for this book. It's so timely. My grandmother was a sharecropper. And I just want to know, did you at all in the book explore, like, the impact of, I guess, the manipulation and the, I guess, the exploitation as far as, like, sharecroppers were concerned and the impact on the mental health of the people that it affected and how it affected, I guess, like, family life or, you know, overall peace and things like that. Like, did you explore that in the book? I wasn't sure.
So that's where the book begins. You know, Solicitor Duncan, who is my great-grandfather, was a sharecropper in Comer, Georgia, and so that's where I start. And so, I mean, I don't know that I explore mental health in any profound, you know, profoundly deep way, but I think by just telling the story of the kind of subjugation and silence that was required I talk also in the chapter on my grandfather in Accomack, Virginia, and sort of the subjugation that both he and a woman whose oral history I found, which was really incredible, who was a migrant to Philadelphia, talks about just the humiliation and the pain of having to watch her father accept the unacceptable over and over and over again, and that was what drove her to want to leave. And she literally like fled with no suitcase. She just ran away as a teenager, probably around the time that my grandfather, Bruce Murphy, also did the same. Yeah, yes, but I mean, I'm not a psychologist, so.
Again, it's gonna sound like I'm just shading other people, but I'm not. In the last 10 years, again, I'm just thinking about as a bookstore owner, purely as a bookstore owner, I watch what books people buy. And there are some very popular accounts of our past, I use that language, that are compelling and mm-hmm. beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm not a historian by any stretch. But I suspect that if you subjected them to sufficient archival scrutiny, one might find more sizzle than steak. What your book does, I think, so wonderfully, is that you allow us to experience the beauty of Black people through your writing. But the stuff really happened.
Yeah. I have a lot of footnotes in the book.
A lot of footnotes. How do you...
Not footnotes, endnotes.
Yes.
You don't have to read them.
Yeah.
But if you want
to
read them...
But you should, though. My question is sort of, how do you... And maybe it's not hard for you. How do you strike a balance, though? Or what is your journey like? And this is sort of somewhat of a writerly mm-hmm. question. Mm-hmm. How do you strike the balance of telling this beautiful story or giving me this beautiful image of what happened and still being having fidelity to what we know? Because it's not that people just make stuff up that's completely counterfactual. Sometimes they do.
Yeah.
But a lot of time what it feels like is... Mm-hmm. The archive says John was sitting at the Woolworth counter in 1934. Mm-hmm. And when they start writing, it's John could feel the heat of the baseball bat against the side of his skull. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you don't know that. John ain't say that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
I know John got hit with a bat.
Yes.
And I know he was in Woolworth. That's all I got, right?
Yes.
And those little gaps are the difference between scholars and whatever else you people are.
Yes.
How do you navigate trying to give us the beautiful picture when so many things in history are constantly being woven together and told?
So for me, I love that game. Like, I love being a historian. I'm not just a writer. I'm not a novelist. I'm not, just a creative person. I think I am a creative person. But for me, the jigsaw puzzle of putting together a whole lot of little tiny things to tell a story and tell a rich story. Like, I'll check the weather on a day. I will literally go back in the almanac and say, well, was it really hot that summer? Or was it a...
Because racism was supposed to be hot.
Yeah.
Like, so, nobody wants to hear it was a mild day when they got bit by the dog. Right? It got to be sweltering, right? So that's what I'm saying. Like, some people don't look at the almanac. They're like, shit, this was hot. Racism is hot.
So for me, I want to see all those little things. And find. And for me, the joy of finding... I write about Henry, who is my 3 times great-grandfather, who was in bondage in Elbert County, Georgia, in the first chapter. And I found his name in a slaveholder's will. Mm. I found the document, and historian me was like, well, his name is not in there because the owner had 200 people, and his name's not in there. And something was like, read. And so I sat there at 2 in the morning, and I just kept reading. It's in manuscript, so it's terrible, weird handwriting. And I'm reading, and I'm reading, and I see Henry. And I'm like, wow, that looks like a big old H and the E-N-R-Y.
Wow.
And it said a blacksmith. And I'm like, oh, wow. So I don't know anything about his life as a blacksmith, so I don't write about it, because all I know is that those three words.
Yeah.
But, that tells me a lot, and it tells me what the possibilities are. And so... having the documents to give you the sense of possibilities, to me, is much richer. Having the document of Henry as a free man registering to vote with his ex because he does not know how to write his name because it was forbidden by law for him to write his name as an enslaved person in 1867. Like, that document means way more to me than just me kicking it about what I think he might have felt. I mean, I know what his ex looks like on a piece of paper because I've seen it for myself. And so that I love that journey because that excites me, to find those documents, to find the things that help you put the story together, to find my washerwoman, Sarah Hill, in the census, to figure out that, you know, through the census that she loses a child around the age of 10, that she doesn't tell the oral historian that comes to her door. She says, you know, I only have, you know, she shades that word about how many kids she has because she's lost a child. And I can see that in the document. So for me, I don't want to make that stuff up. I don't want to speak into it if I don't know it. I really want to know it. And I think the knowing and the care in knowing is what they deserve.
This book captures all of that beauty. Family, I promise you this book is worth every minute that you spend reading it. It is captivating. It is brilliant. It is innovative. It is passionate. It is loving. It's just dripping with love for us and our struggle and our journey. And I'm so grateful that you let me spend some time with you talking about it. And I'm so grateful you all hung out with us. So please, at this point, I'll bring them up to do the talking about what how to get out there and buy this wonderful book. But I strongly encourage everybody to support this work, to support this book. In fact, buy one for a friend. It's worth it because I think everyone needs to read this history. Everyone needs to be a part of this journey. Blair, again, thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for
hanging out
with me.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.